Hello and welcome to the Eat PhD Team podcast, the podcast here to help you with your relationship with food and body by giving you evidence-based techniques to support yourself with a sprinkling of feminism, a dash of dismantling diet culture and a side of vulnerability as we share our own messy lives with you. I'm Emilia, a registered nutritionist and PhD with the sole purpose of making your life happier and healthier. If you love it, please do go wild and share it. And if you're ready for support with our coaching, details are in the show notes. Hello and welcome to episode number 301 of the Eat PhD Team podcast with myself and Roslyn. Hi Roslyn, how are you?
I am good. I think, I don't know if I'm jet lagged. Everyone, I'm back in the UK. Yay! Woo-hoo! Literally not even back for 24 hours. I actually think, I was speaking to Becca earlier and I was like, I think I've been a really bad example to the people we work with of like how not to manage your work-life balance. These things happen and I apologize in advance for any of my answers today.
They'll be good. I do think sometimes when you're tired, you plural, you think less, and actually some of the stuff that you say tends to be either funnier or more accurate because you have less time to kind of mull over and then think, I wonder if I should say this. You just, well, you have the time, you just don't have the cognitive ability to do it. So I can't wait, to be honest. I think it's going to be a good time. How are you, Anna?
I'm good, thank you. All good. We were just saying, very fed up of this weather. I really thought spring was on its way, and then this week, less so.
It's kind of like that way where you can get two seasons in one day. I feel like this week I've seen days where it's like so blue. And I think, oh, it's so spring-like, it's beautiful. And then literally I will be working and I think, oh, I'll go for a walk after work. And then it's just like torrential downpours on the same day. And just, it's a wild time to be British. But then this is what happens every single year. And every year we're like, oh, the weather. Gosh.
To be fair, when I landed yesterday and I was waiting to get picked up, like the coldness hit my face, but I actually kind of liked it. Like, because I was like, my face hasn't felt like this in a year. And I was like, maybe it was like appreciation for, and then my dad was like, you're romanticizing it, you'll get over it.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, like, I totally know what you mean. And when I come back from Austin, I'm like, oh, it's so fresh. Mm. I quite like to wrap up and be warm. And I mean, it is very grey, but I'm kind of still just like, it's not grey.
You're still there.
Bothered by it still. So, and I wasn't there for as long as you.
You know what? I am on my second pair of wellies this winter. I'm just done. Really, really done. I know it's my problem having animals that require me to be outside every day, but I'm really done. Just done.
Fair. I don't have any requirement to actually be in the bad weather, let's be honest, apart from the fact that I should probably go for a walk at some point in the day. Avoiding the meant to be. So yeah, that's fair. Okay. Do we get started on the questions? Also, before we do, actually, have you seen the New York Times article about Andrew Huberman? Has anyone seen that?
I seen a meme today.
That'll probably be based on that. I haven't read the full article, but there's two sides to it. There's the one, there's like the salacious gossip type of side of, I think that he, now I'm not 100% sure. I think the article said something like he was seeing multiple women or something like that. Who cares? I don't care about his personal life. But what's great about it is that, and I feel a bit sorry for anyone who gets outed in this way, I guess. But what's great about it is that they've kind of, people are coming out and saying, yeah, all of the evidence-based people for years have been saying that he's a neuroscientist and he knows about neuroscience and he doesn't know about nutrition or physiology or all of the neuroscience is physiology, but these other aspects, behavior change, and he just cites research and everyone thinks it's evidence-based. And I've seen some really good posts around the actual evidence base behind a lot of what he says. And as much as I hate like this, I don't like cancel culture and I'm not for it actually at all, pretty much ever. There are obviously some exceptions to that. Usually people who are sexual abusers tend to kind of tick that box. But I do think it's opened up good discussion around podcast nutrition, because the thing about someone like Andrew Huberman is that you then get all of these men with podcasts getting him on their podcast and then reciting exactly what they hear from him on their podcast, because that's where they get all of their information. Then they pad it to someone else's podcast as if they're the expert, and it just goes round and round. And it's like, you know, there could be a piece of research on a rat one time on, you know, some sort of nutrient in isolation. It's gone, you know, Andrew Huberman said, oh, if you take this supplement, then, you know, it cures dementia. And then someone else copies it and it goes around. And it's like, oh yeah, that's on, you know, six rats one time in the 60s. He did not say that, by the way. I'm not slandering him in any way, but I think it's good to bring awareness to that, the topic of a whole of like that kind of, if someone's podcast is not run by people of that field, it is probably not something that you want to take advice from. In general, don't take nutrition advice from a podcast that's not run by nutritionists or dietitians.
I've actually got something to add on to that. I read a thread earlier, but I don't actually have threads, so I read whatever someone screenshot it off threads. And it was in America, but it was a doctor saying she just saved her patient thousands of dollars because the patient was on 100 supplements a day and she literally like whittled it down to like 3. And then she was like, guess who recommended these supplements? And it was Andrew Huberman, but also another guy. I can't remember his name, but I recognized it. And it got me thinking something that it's been in the back of my mind for a while. The last couple of, over the last, 3-4 months, the last couple of like new clients that I've had sign up with me, whenever I've looked at their starting signups, I've noticed an increasing number of people on an increasing number of supplements.
Interesting.
That I've like kind of said to them, like, and obviously I'm just getting to know these people, so I don't want to be like, you don't need any of these. But I went in quite gently, like, oh, where did you think that you need to be on this from? And it got me thinking, like, oh my gosh, that trend that I'm seeing just from like the small scope of people that I work with, probably thousands of us nutritionists and dietitians are actually seeing this on like a really massive level, and it's because of these podcasts.
Yeah, it really is. I think they have so much to answer for. And just it's just the parroting. You get these big voices that then end up parroting on multiple podcasts at one time. And it's dangerous, to say the least. Supplements are just mostly dangerous to your finances, but sometimes potentially not. Sometimes they can do harm. The other rant that I've got that I just ranted on Instagram about is, so I really like Mark Manson. I've read a couple of his books. I think I really like the way he thinks. I don't agree with everything that he says, but I like some of the way he frames things. And he put a post up that says, why more people are giving up on relationships. I don't know if you've noticed, but people aren't feeling the need to put effort into relationships anymore. They're starting to say they'd rather stay single forever. What is it in today's world that makes people feel like it's too much effort? Is it the expectations or the Instagram model standards? Or is it the fact that we've made ourselves so aware of red flags that finding a partner without them seems nearly impossible? And then he says, you know, I felt this way when I was younger. I hated commitment and I didn't want to put the result into the efforts. It didn't put the efforts into relationships and it showed. So I spent a period where I completely gave up on relationships. I figured I'd be single for the rest of my life. And now he's giving out dating advice. And I got really triggered by it. One, because of some people who liked it. I was deciding how much I was going to share there. But mostly because it's and I'm being quite generic here, not all men, not all women, right? It's such a current male podcaster stance. People just don't want to put the work in anymore. And women are over here like, we've been putting the work into relationships and staying in shit relationships for our entire lives. We have been martyring ourselves, you know, being quote-unquote selfless, putting other people first, trying to, again, be in these codependent healing relationships, fix other people. And I'm not saying that's healthy effort, by the way, understandable. But it's like the narrative around dating at the moment is women are saying, again, not all, right? Women are saying, you know, have boundaries, develop your self-worth, develop your self-esteem away from the relationships, know your worth, communicate your needs, don't date for potential, don't. And so we're being empowered to be like, no, like, no, we know what we're worth, and we're not going to settle for something less than that, but we will continue to do the work because this is what we do. We've always done the work. And then there's the male narrative, not all men, the podcast I'm talking about, a lot of podcasts who give out dating advice are like, people just don't want to make effort anymore, shaming people for walking away because they're not used to women, in my opinion, stepping up and being like, this is not good enough for me, I would rather be single. We know from the research that people who are married are not happier than people who are single. We also know from the research that people who are single, well, not married, have better connections and report less loneliness. So you can't come to us and say, well, you know, social isolation, blah, blah, blah. Like, that doesn't come from marriage. It comes from the connections that we have. It doesn't come from dating. It comes from the relationships that we have. I love love. Like, I love relationships. But I'm also like, don't you fucking dare say to a large majority of women, oh, we just, you know, we just jump onto the next thing and we just don't want to put the work in anymore. Bullshit. You've realized that you have to start doing work now as men, and you realize that women are walking away. So you're taking this narrative of like, people just don't want to make the effort anymore. And it's so clear for me, and I have a lot of biases, obviously, the dichotomy between like the not all men narrative and the not all women narrative. And I hate how it is so dichotomous. I don't want it to be like men versus women, but it pisses me off because I think of all the thousands of women that I've worked with who put so much into all of their relationships, who put everyone else before themselves. And then they see messages like that, like, oh, maybe I gave up too early. Maybe I should go back to that person. Maybe I was looking for the red flags. When it's like, we've only just realized, it, you know, as we get older, to not run to these red flags. And now we're being shamed for noticing them and leaving. It's wild. That is a big rant, but I saw it today and I was really, really pissed off. And I was pissed off at like some of the comments just kind of confirmed, especially from some of the men, just confirmed that narrative of like, yeah, feminism, it's feminism. Is it? If feminism is responsible for women standing up and knowing what their worth is and not staying in shit relationships, then good for feminism. That's a man problem. It's not an us problem. Again, that was very us versus them. I realised, as I said, man and then us. But, and I say that knowing that I am growing a penis. So I'm very aware. I mean, inside my belly, I'm not personally growing a penis. So I am mindful. And I love men, but I don't love that narrative. And especially from non-dating experts who have podcasts. So everyone can look at that post if they want to be enraged. Or if you disagree, tell me. I'd love to know. I probably am biased. Okay, now shall we get on with the question? Ross, do you want to go first?
Yes. By the way, I love the rant. So I do.
Thanks.
I love men, but not all men. This question's from one of Katie's clients that she works with. My little sister is 18 and she always calls herself fat and criticizes herself. I never know what to say to support her and not so much emphasis on how she looks. Any advice or things to say to help?
I think a couple of things. Sometimes people are a little bit too close for you to help them. And it might not be the right space or connection or relationship for you to help specifically with that. I think sometimes with sisters, younger sisters, like you are similar to like daughters in some ways, like you are kind of modeling behavior. And one of the best things that you can do since you're working with Katie is doing the work with Katie and modeling that around her. I think that's probably one of the best things you could do. And depending on your relationship, you know, you could ask things like, oh, how does it feel when you call yourself that? I wonder like where you've got that idea from. And you could encourage curiosity around it as opposed to giving a specific advice. That would probably be my recommended approach.
Yeah. So I was actually, I've had a very busy 20 hours since being back in the UK, and I went to see my little sister's final dress fitting last night for a wedding dress. And there's a lot of comments about her appearance in the dress, weight, body shape and size. But and what I noticed actually, and I thought it was really good, was the bridal lady. Like she didn't say, no, you don't need to, or yes, you do. She said nothing. And I actually was like, sometimes that's the best thing to do. And I think whenever your little sister's making these comments, sometimes positive like feeding into it is like, she's gonna be like, every time I bring this up, I get not attention for it, but I get this attention off my sister and it opens up. And maybe sometimes when she brings it up, maybe just say nothing and see, like, does that impact, you know, how often she brings it up. And it maybe kind of shows her that there's, I don't mean it's a harsh way, but there's more interesting things about her. There's more interesting things to talk about alongside doing the work with Katie and kind of now and again having the curious questions. But yeah, I really noticed that last night of the lady in the dress shop. I was like, oh, I like that she's just saying nothing, because the conversation just moved on quickly as well. And I also said nothing.
Well done. Well done. I totally agree. And I think that must be hard when you're in the shop. You work in the shop to not say something.
Mm-hmm. But they must get it all the time. Sorry as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think I maybe said, I think it was on the First Time Mother by Choice podcast, that I spoke to a sonographer who does ultrasound scans for pregnancy on Instagram when I'd said that I wasn't sharing how many weeks I was, because I don't want to exacerbate body comparison. And she said in that line of work, should people come in all the time and they're worried because they're told their bump is too big or their bump is too small. And they're asking me, like, should I be this size? Should I have gained this much weight? Should I have not gained this much weight? And she said it's wild, the opinions that people have, and it's usually always come from comments from other people about that. And so I think it's a similar sort of line of work, isn't it, where, well, of course you want to diet for a wedding, like, why? Or, like, of course, like, you want to just be bump or whatever it is. And it's like these expectations of, like, they're all absolute bull. I did go in for a scan in the last couple of weeks, and I had a full bladder, because you're supposed to have you're not supposed to have an empty bladder to help with the scan. And I went in and I lay down, and I don't really look, I'm not looking at my bump regularly, and I was like, oh my god, like, my bump looks really big, like he's really grown. And then she was like, how can you breathe, your bladder's so full. And he wasn't moving very much, and he's always really active. She was like, he's not really moving, I think you need to go and empty your bladder. And it's basically like he was just squashed into this tiny space. My bladder was so full. And then I came back, I went for a pee, and I came back, and baby Zad was like, your stomach is like half the size. It just completely deflated. And I was like, I've never, obviously when you need a pee, like, you get a wee bit bloated, but I've never seen it to that extent where it was like, oh, my bump has just disappeared, and it was just all pee. That was a nice wee story for you. Learning something new every day about bodies, you know.
Poor little squash baby.
I know, I did feel bad, because then I was like, is that what happens to him every time I need a pee? I mean, I do obviously try and go to pee when I need to go. Sometimes you just can't. So now I'll try hard. Who knew? I mean, it makes sense, right? There's just getting less and less space in there. So I guess that's what's going to happen. Okay. Anna, question.
Good job, Roz is on the pod. Hot yoga, what is the hype? Is it better than a normal yoga class?
So, this is my brain. No, it's just you're hotter, so your muscles are more like warmed up already. So it allows you to get into some of those more challenging poses, or more like quote unquote poses you need to be flexible for. So there is some like benefits around it. I think it really came from like the 80s, from like Bikram yoga. However, on one of my deep dives that I do when I get obsessed with something, the guy, I can't remember his first name, Bikram surname, he's got a very interesting history of like sexual assault cases and the like. And I suppose like where yoga typically comes from, like India, it's going to be like a hotter climate, more humid, so it's trying to like mimic that. But it's not necessary for your personal practice, so it's not. But if you like it, you like it, and that's it.
Yeah,
there is a hot series, like Hot 26, which Bikram created. It's like 26 poses that you do. I personally like disagree with that type of yoga, because I feel like there's no room for embodiment and like mind-body connection, and no room to explore your body in the pose. But that's because I'm very passionate about embodiment yoga, and I think that's where like freer flows can increase that embodiment.
Yeah. There's no physiological benefit. Like there's no, it's not like it, and don't, you don't think you're gonna like get more flexible, or you're gonna burn more calories, because obviously that's not why we're doing yoga. But there is that narrative. I don't know about you guys, but I've had that transition. I used to do Bikram. I remember I got a nosebleed in Bikram and I wasn't allowed to leave the room. I was like, I've got a nosebleed, because it's like a steam room. But I went through that transition of hating yoga, doing Bikram yoga for 90 minutes where you feel like death, but it's really hard, so you feel really accomplished after it. Then moving on to hot yoga, because again, it just feels a little bit tougher. You can bend a little bit more, and it still feels like more of a workout. And now I'm like, nah, like I like it to be warm enough where my feet and hands and feet are not cold. But I like to be, the idea, obviously, of course, is mindfulness, is embodiment. It's not about how hard can you work, although of course it's great to push yourself, especially in certain types of yoga classes, right? But I do think there's definitely a tendency, and we used to see a lot of people, so I think the studio that I used to go to, this was years ago, I don't know if they had a relationship with an eating disorder support group or something, but I know that, I just know from conversations with people, I'm not saying based on appearance, that people who were coming from eating disorders went to Bikram. And I think that they probably got it sold to them as like, you can do yoga. And then that was like that potentially was the one, because it still feels quite masochistic. It still feels quite hard. It still feels like it's another way to help try and regulate yourself, right? That's not, if you can't do full force high intensity exercise, I feel like Bikram and hot yoga almost become like a bit of a replacement sometimes. I don't mean in eating disorders, I just mean in general.
I definitely saw that in Australia. Oh, sorry, Anna. I was actually quite shocked and disheartened by the hot yoga community in Australia. Whereas I think like in the UK, there's some hot yoga studios, but it's just that the studio's hot. It's like you can still do like a yin class, you can still do a slow flow or something like that. And I actually was in a hot yoga studio in Perth, and someone was behind these two ladies when they walked out, and they're like, that was such a good workout today, wasn't it? And I really wanted to like interrupt them and be like, yoga's not a workout, it's a work-in. And actually there's a local studio to me like at home, and they've just opened up like a warm room, like in addition to their studio, and the advertising they put was benefits of hot yoga, burns more calories. And I sat on it for a good couple of days. I was like, should I message them, should I not? And I just decided not to message them, because I was like, in my headspace at the minute, I just need to pick my battles. But I was really disheartened, because I actually spoke at the studio at one point about mindful eating and like relationship with food and body, and then to see them advertising hot yoga burns more calories, I was like, but I was like, I need to pick my battles with people at the minute. So
fair.
No, I love, and two part. I found an instructor that I love at Hot Pod, but I do love it for the warmth. And if I'm having like, if I'm sore, then like you were saying, Roz, it just helps you kind of like, I can feel everything just melt into the pose. And thankfully, because I think I've done, I remember like Amelia, when you were getting, or when I was trying to get you into yoga, and you were like, I like it faster. And I was like, I like it really slow. But I think because I did that, I have no problem in going into Hot Pod and being like, I don't want to do that, or I'll just like skip that vinyasa or do a regression depending where I'm at. But obviously the one closest to me is Loughborough. Loughborough is a very sporty town, and I'd say 80% of the people in the class are like, before the class, they're starting their watch up. I'm like, no guys, please. I just sit there with my eyes shut. I'm like, no.
I'm in a warm cocoon. This is fine. I know. Yeah. Hot Pod is nice when it's cold, especially when it's cold. I don't have one near me. Okay. Emilia, I have spoken before about how your natural set point is probably higher than you think it is, but what if it's not what you want and you feel it's just a touch too much body fat? Will you always be fighting against yourself? I'm going to just jump in first here a little bit in terms of the terminology. A touch too much body fat for you is constantly, forever fighting against yourself to lose a touch of body fat. Is that a sacrifice that you want to make? Is the first question. Because what is a touch too much body fat? It's probably not going to be a level of body fat that's impacting your health. More, it's not that your natural set point is probably higher than you think it is for everyone. It's not so much that. It's more that often we want it to be lower than it is, and it's a settling range. So if it's a touch too much body fat for you, when we're looking at a settling range, it's probably like 3 to 5 kilos. So at some points, it won't be a touch too much body fat, and sometimes it might feel a little bit like that. And I think getting comfortable with these natural fluctuations at what maintenance actually is, where you do see those fluctuations, is really, really important. Your body is not supposed to stay at this specific weight forever. That's not the way that your body works. Your body, I think I said in my email on Monday, like it's like a tapestry of your life. And if you're living a life, that tapestry is going to be patterned and colorful, and it's going to change, and it's not going to look like, a black and white photograph on the wall. That's just not life. But ultimately, like, it's a choice. The point is, if you want to maintain below your settling range, which, by the way, is usually your healthiest body fat range and body weight, and when we're saying healthiest, we're looking at body fat levels, energy levels, relationship with food, relationship with body, etc. Your settling range is the healthiest place. If you would rather be below that and sacrifice a bit of that health and put in a lot of sacrifice, or more sacrifice rather, not necessarily a lot, but more sacrifice to stay below that, that is absolutely your choice. Absolutely your choice. But I would question what your reason is for that, and if how that aligns with your values.
I was having a conversation yesterday with a client, and we've both competed, and we're both saying how kind of we're at that point with bodies now, where like accepting neutral, and it just maintains quite happily. But we were both saying how the expectation of what we thought would maintenance would look like for me, it was kind of like 6 weeks out of comp, where you're fairly lean, but not like the skeletal stage. And I was like, yeah, this could easily be maintained. Not really thinking that at the time I wasn't socializing, I wasn't eating out, I wasn't drinking. I mean, hopefully we're coming into Aperol Spritz season, like, fingers crossed. Like, I don't want to be missing out on that. And I was also doing bags of cardio. Like, I don't want to go back to that. That's not a sacrifice that I'm willing to make. And I think it's when you're at that point, and I mean, yes, we can bang on about values, but actually, like, am I willing to give up the life that I really enjoy just for a slightly smaller body? Like, nah, not for me anyway.
That 6 week out point, I remember it too. You start dieting, you're a couple of months in, and you're like, this is it. This is I could easily maintain this. It's always about 6 weeks out with your first show. I don't know why.
I was like, this is great, this is so great. Like, had some I mean that abs for me was what I would be like, yeah, that was my only goal. I didn't really care what happened on the stage. I was like, if I've got abs, and I've won. Yeah, like that faint, and you're like, yeah, this is great, this is great. And then you reach the deep dark depths of prepping, like, this is not so good anymore.
I don't have much to add to your answer, Amelia, but I have to say that the red flag in that question to me was the phrase touch of body fat. And I think that's something you could explore. I think that's where you need to do a little bit more work with Georgia, and then that'll help you answer your own question, maybe.
Agree. Roz, I think. Sorry.
No, this is my client. Yay. Hello. maybe around, so the question is, how to get back to being more intuitive with food when you've had not a binge day, but a whole binge period of a week or two? I guess the answer is different for each person, but the people on the podcast who've recovered from overeating may remember a bumpy road to recovery, and how did they deal with bigger, longer setbacks? Like, practically, did they implement anything other than simply self-compassion?
Good question. I mean, I remember setbacks. many setbacks. And there'll be times now, by the way, where I overeat. I'm not saying binge eat, but where I could overeat, you know, for a period of a week at a time. You know, if I'm going through something really hard, and I still will emotionally eat sometimes, and I own that because it does often support me, to be honest. To a certain extent. It's not my only coping mechanism. I will do my yoga and then I will eat my brownie. So this is not something that will, that is, you know, this massive far off thing that I have to throw my mind all the way back to remember. But when I was healing my relationship with food before I got to this point, and with the clients that I work with who also experience things like this, it's annoying because I am going to say a large part of it is self-compassion. A large part of it is. And it's not just about self-kindness, remember. It's also kind of thinking about your future self, thinking about yourself tomorrow, taking action to support your tomorrow self. But there's also that piece of common humanity of just reminding yourself that this is not your problem. You're not broken. It's not like you've messed up your journey on healing your relationship with food. This is it. Lots of people go through this, and rather than getting really frustrated at yourself about it, can you just show yourself that compassion and remind yourself you're not on your own, and these times will happen. I think, I know you're wanting for something, you want something tangible and practical. The key thing, I think, for a lot of people is increasing meal size, and increasing meal regularity and front loading more calories. Now, again, I'm making the disclaimer. I know you work with Roz, and I don't know your situation. I don't know who it is that's asked this question. I'm making the disclaimer that for my clients and myself, it's disordered eating and not eating disorder. And Roz might have something different to say for this, but in my experience in that realm, it's most people find it really helpful to eat more than they are. And often in your recovery from overeating, you get used to eating regularly, and over time you start to just get a bit more lax with it, which is okay, but you start to reduce your portion sizes a little bit, so now you're not even conscious. And so it's just bringing the intention back specifically to, okay, maybe I can just have a little bit more oats in my breakfast in the morning, or, you know, my morning snack is usually Greek yogurt with fruit. Maybe I can add some nuts and seeds and things back in there again. Just eat more, be more mindful of that, and eat those things mindfully. That's probably, for me, aside from the self-compassion and people that I work with, that tends to be one of the key practical tools.
Yeah, like if you think, because the first part of the question was like how to get back into like intuitive, and that is key. Because if you've had a couple of weeks where there has been overeating or binging, that's how your hunger hormones are going to regulate. That's how you get back in tune with your body, by eating regularly. And I would also add, just kind of, I know Amelia was saying like be mindful when you eat, but having a mindful moment, having a body check-in as well, so you can actually get a feel for, okay, how am I feeling? What does my body need today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't have much more to add. It's, I like what you said, Amelia, like also maybe like add more fiber in, more fats in, because we know that's going to satiate you. And maybe as well, sometimes when this happens and you have a setback, it can feel like you're spiraling, and it can feel like you're spiraling like out of control, just thinking about some of the people I'm working with at the minute. And it's maybe also that deeper question of what is it that I'm trying to get control of? Because maybe there's something that's a little life event, not even a little life event, maybe there's like a combination of like life events that have just been happening. And sometimes in recovery, life goes smoothly and we're like, we're nailing the habits, we're doing the work, and it's all brilliant. And then these obstacles pop up and it's the first time we've been tested in our recovery journey. And we're like, oh, like I was gonna say, shit hits the fan. What do we do? Go back to binging. And it's just, that's part of the recovery. It's like, you know, if we do a little graph, you're probably still progressing. It's not a setback. It's just a little, oh, one step back, but you're still going two steps forward. So we can just look over the last 2 weeks, like what's changed. Maybe nothing's changed as well. That's really important. Maybe it's just part of recovery. And that's, it can be really empowering to be like, this is recovery and it's just really challenging. So it is.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why, like, I will happily say on this podcast, like I just did, oh, there'll be times when I emotionally eat and I do these things now, because I do think it's so important that collectively we are saying it's normal for these things to happen. And it's not like a light switch on and off. This whole thing is a journey, and I genuinely have a good relationship with food. I have a really pretty great relationship with food, but sometimes I'll emotionally eat. And you know, I think just reminding yourself of that is really important. So I love that. Anna.
I follow a resistance training program which covers push, pull, rotation / anti-rotation, squat, hinge, unilateral work, some jumping and mobility, and I pay a PT for it. It feels pretty all-encompassing, and I'm thinking, is this structure that I'll be following for life? Is this it now? I just do this until I'm 90. Is it that simple? If my goals remains, do resistance training to be healthy.
You can do. It sounds pretty thorough. I obviously don't know the quality of it. You can do. But realistically, you know, you might get injured. You might change your preferences. You might get bored. You might fall pregnant. You might... There's so many situations where that might not necessarily be the best thing, or you might not want to do it anymore and you'll change. And there are people that I work with, and I would include myself in this actually, where I've done optimal training in different versions for the last, you know, 15 years of my life or something. But the type of training I do now, 5 years ago, I would be like, I'm not doing that. That's not going to build me the most muscle. That's not going to get me the strongest. I'm not going to fanny around with mobility and whatever else. Like, why would I do that? Now, not all of it. I don't love all of it. And I actually got my check-in feedback today and he was like, I'm happy with you today. The reason I got angry with you last week, and I was like, oh, I'm sorry. So like I don't always love everything that I do. But if I look back at the training I did 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I'm like, I would never do that now. And that was just pure strength, hypertrophy. I don't know how many days a week, 5 days a week or whatever it was. Didn't run. And now it's much more holistic. So point I'm trying to make is your preferences are probably going to change. Your needs are going to probably want to change. And you might do this for 5, 10 years. You might love it. But then you might get bored and you think, I want to do something else. It might not be optimal for something, but does that, how much does that matter? Like, not everything is optimal all of the time, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Becca's client's question. This is totally unrelated to food and body. I do like when questions are totally unrelated to food and body. I mean, obviously I love food and body questions, but I do like when they're rogue. So this is totally unrelated to food and body, but I know lots of you at ETPhD have done further study. What were your methods or non-negotiables in these periods when trying to balance your health, your job, and all other elements?
So I'm like, tell me the answer, please, because today I got accepted onto like a master's module in May and June for eating disorders for dietitians. So Can't wait for that. No,
I also
my.
love, Roz, that we were just literally talking last week about like how you might navigate your schedule when you come back, and me sort of saying, you know what, you might want to not commit to all of these things, but maybe some of these things.
You
Nice
know
to
what it's
add that in.
like? Yeah, because I compartmentalize, which is like terrible. So whenever I was talking to you like about yoga as well, it's as if I see everything separate, but actually it's all one.
Yeah.
But that's what's funny. I've done lots of like in the last 3 years, loads of like different yoga, and it's been like loads of self-study, and then obviously like doing the trainings and doing that as like alongside like coaching as well, and also like CPD for like nutrition. But I think for me, with like the non-negotiables, it's just adding that into your routine. So say if you've got like whatever your job is, if it's 9 to 5 or 8 to 7 or whatever, and then you've got maybe a routine already established for fitness or health, it's just kind of compassionately, as you said, Amelia, viewing like, do you have room? If you don't have room, kind of like, what's the priority? And it was actually my mentor when I worked in the NHS. I really liked this. She said her and her partner have these like seasons in their life where maybe like this quarter it's a career focused quarter, and then the next quarter it might be like they had kids, so it was like, we're not going to do anything career wise because a busy season for the kids. And there was like a partnership, so they're like, this quarter he's doing his master's, so I'm just running the household. And but it was the way she like, it wasn't even quarters, it was just seasons. And I was like, that's such, I think, a sustainable way to look at it. It's not forever, so it's not. And maybe just knowing this season, training is going to maybe not be priority of the list. Like, still get your steps, still get like a gym session, but maybe this season it's going to be study. And it's not forever, because then the study will end and then you'll take those skills and that'll open up time for, not for something else, just for you to go back to enjoying life again.
I was laughing because as well, you both know, but I'm doing my trauma course, but it's going very slowly. And I think this is the thing for me, is that I need, like, when I was doing my counselling, which I will be applying for soon. Obviously you had to show up, like it was an in-person thing that you had to show up for. And like you were saying, Roz, you plan it in. And even though I leave time in the week for my own study at the moment, I need someone there. And maybe, Amelia, that's something that we talk about potentially. But I, similar to what you were saying, Roz, in like the seasons, when I talk about like preventing burnout, I really like the four burner analogy, in that like you've got everything on the top of the stove, and okay, what are you going to kind of focus on? What needs to be turned down a little bit, because you can't give your all to everything. So there is going to need to be some compromise, and that might mean, like you were saying, training. It might mean if you're going out dating, maybe that's put on the back burner for a little bit whilst you focus on study and rest and whatever else is important.
I totally agree with all of that. And the only thing I would add is acceptance is really important here, in that no one thinks this is going to feel easy. And I think when you try and do it all of the time, is when you can fall into that dysregulated, overdoing, not looking after yourself space. And it's not a particularly healthful space for you to be in terms of your mental health and your physical health. And me, when I was doing my undergraduate degree, I finished that so anxious, so underweight, so just in a really unhealthful position because I tried to do it all. And then it was not a good time. And that was obviously a long, long time ago. But I think if I look at my experience now with pregnancy, obviously in my second trimester, I'm a bit more like, okay, I'm here, I'm doing things, I'm really fired up to like get things in place, especially before I go off for just a little bit. But I've had to accept that even in this thriving apparently trimester, I'm still not myself. I still need more sleep. I still need more breaks. I need more rest. Like, yes, it's infinitely better than that first trimester where I was harder. But even then, like all the way through, it's like the acceptance of at this season of my life. And I think about it in the same way as you were saying, Roz, like in this season of my life, it's about, okay, I know what I have to prioritize. I prioritize the coaches that I work with, the ADHD coaches that I work with, the mentoring coaches that I work with, and my health and my baby. And realistically, everything else has to take a little bit of a downplay a little bit. But the reason I say an acceptance is that is not easy. And I feel guilt most days at the moment for being like, I've not given enough to this person, or I've not put enough into this, or this part of my life, or this thing is struggling a little bit. And that's a daily thing, pretty much. But I have to accept that this is still the healthiest choice. This is still the right thing for me to do. So I just want to, you know, highlight, if you're like, okay, I'm going to do the seasons thing, and then you do it and it's uncomfortable, or you feel guilty and you think, oh, this is not the right thing. That doesn't mean it's not the right thing. It just means that you're probably conditioned to do more all the time. And it just feels unfamiliar to you. So just leaning into that a little bit, excuse me. Is it me? I think it's me. No, that was me. Ross, go for it.
This is one of Becca's clients. Do you think how you feel about your body impacts what you wear? In what way? Have your wardrobe choices changed as you have a better relationship with food and body? Is it possible to get to a point of wearing what you want and being truly secure in those choices?
I don't think like choices have changed. I think it's more a confidence thing for me. I didn't know whether to take offense the other week when my mum was like, no, you've always had the same style. I'm like, really?
You always have lovely style, Anna. I think you've got beautiful style. I always think that.
I would say questionable at times. But genuinely, I think it is, well, maybe kind of, again, going back to competing days, I would hold on to the leaner wardrobe because I'd be like, oh, I'll fit back in there at some point. And now I'm just like, no, just wear for the body that you're in. And I do opt for comfy, like semi-baggy clothing, just because like I've realized how much tight clothing like makes me feel quite stressed and almost what's the word, claustrophobic. But it's not from me trying to hide my body, it's just actually this is how I feel my best, and when I feel my best I show up as like my best self.
I think that's kind of interesting, because of course how you feel about your body impacts what you wear. You know, if you feel bloated and sluggish, you probably wear comfier, baggier clothes, probably, or a lot of people will, because it's comfortable. Or maybe if you feel like you've been exercising regularly, you've been nourishing your body well, you've been working on your body image, you might feel, okay, I feel more comfortable to express myself in a way that I want to in my fashion choices. So for sure it can change, but I think it's different for different people, and you can't really exclude body image and just say, oh, my style changed because of my body image. Like for me, my style changed because I saw a mirror one day and realized what I was dressing like. And then but I do think when you improve your body image, I do think you get to, we know that you become more nourishing and nurturing of your body. And so things that restrict you, like you were saying, Anna, or things that are uncomfortable become less appealing because you don't want that on your body. You just want to nourish it and nurture it. And you wouldn't put your toddler in stilettos Well, you might, in which case go you. But because you know they're going to be uncomfortable within 10 minutes. And so you get to the point with your body image where it's like, I don't really want to put these things on my body because they don't feel good. But as you do improve your body image, you feel more comfortable to dress in a way that feels comfortable for you. But I think the reason I'm saying you can't exclude that is because, like, I've got older. I'm 37. I don't care if people don't like what I wear. I wear what I would have old in the past me would have thought was really ugly, whereas now I'm like, yeah, love my baggy pants and whatever else. I don't really care. So yeah, you get more confident within yourself as a soul, and you detach yourself from your body in the sense of I am not my body, and so you're soul becomes fuller and you feel more confident to be like, screw this, I'm wearing like ugly clothes to go for a walk, or in my case I wear my pajamas in the morning with my big coat on, my anti-sexual assault coat, because it's so ugly. Not that that's like, this is a joke, obviously I don't believe that those things are related. So yeah, I do think it changes.
Sorry, I'm just laughing so much at that because I have like a dry robe, and like last year in Wales I was like leaving the house, like walking the dog in like the dry robe, baggy, like my boyfriend's tracksuits and maybe like welly boots. And me and my boyfriend were like laughing because I was like, do you think I'll be wearing that dry robe next week? And he was like, I love that you just walked around the town in that. You just didn't care how you looked. And I was like, it was just like warm from like practicalities. But I agree with what you said. And something that when you were talking, I was like, for me, like, I was like, I don't know what my style is right now, because I spent the last year in a bikini, a crop top, and a pair of shorts. But that was nothing to do with my body image. It literally was like, also exposure. Like, I was in, like, every day I was seeing people wearing shorts, bikini. And I just wore that more and more. And it just became, that was just my uniform. And it was just, like, so normal. I was actually thinking, like, I trained in, like, lycra shorts. And I was like, I wonder if when I'll train in shorts in the gym in the UK, or will I go back to wearing like long leggings? Because now long leggings feel really claustrophobic to me, because I've spent like, and for me, it's not about, and maybe if I had a bad body image, I'll just put like a baggy t-shirt over like the tighter shorts. But yeah, I was like, it wasn't, I don't know if that's how far my body image has come, that it doesn't come down to that anymore. It's about comfort. And as you said, Anna, yeah, being comfortable as well. There's nothing worse. When you're not comfortable in the clothes, regardless of your body image today, it's just going to impact, well, impacts me anyway. So comfort is key, like my oversized hoodie right now.
Do you know what I think is interesting too? Like when I was younger, when I had my worst body image, I would wear the least clothes and the tightest clothes. And I would just, like, I wouldn't eat, again, this is me saying the wrong thing to do. I wouldn't eat all day, and then I'd wear like a bodycon dress, and I wouldn't drink too much water because I thought it made me my abs look better if I didn't drink as much water. And I would wear crop tops, and now I'm just like, I've got the best body I've ever had. And I'm like, no thanks. I'd rather just have, like, I do love tight clothes sometimes, but like most of the time it's like, no, I never dress like that anymore.
We're like all nodding our heads. Yeah.
Yeah.
My honest. Days, it's like the more boobs out, the better.
Yeah.
And like, oh my goodness.
Do you think it's a validation thing, or do you think it was just a style at that time thing?
I mean, definitely the style, because I was like 2010s when I was at uni, and those ribbed bodycons were like,
yeah,
all cringe. But I think when I reflect on it, I think it was validation and seeking a validation. I don't know if it was from the male gaze or like my gaze, like for myself, but I think I thought I had to, I wasn't confident. Like my confidence is, I'm more self-assured and self-esteem now. So I think it was actually insecurity, but how mad that you're insecure, so you just wore less clothes. Yeah.
Well, I think about it. I definitely, when I was at uni, did similar. And I mean, I didn't have boobs to show, but the, you know, I was showing my ass and tight clothes. And I think about it now, and I definitely had massive internalized weight bias, like it totally internalized an ideal. And I looked at other girls who were leaner and thought they were better than me and they were smarter than me. And because a lot of that, you know, it was like a lot of the dentists, the medics, the quote-unquote smart people that often were the people who were like the leanest and didn't eat much. And so I definitely internalized that. So I would wear all these tight clothes to be like, oh, I'm look how thin I am. I am also as worthy as these people. And it's so clear when you look back on it now, it's quite scary. But I think that was more of mine, of like, it's still the validation thing, but it's based on that internalized thin ideal of thinner means a better person, which is disgusting, but it's the society that we were in. Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for your questions. Keep them coming in. Thank you both. Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And as always, if you did, please do feel free to like, share, subscribe, and review. And if you would like to chat to me, then you can find details of my Instagram in the show notes.